From California to New Jersey, Wisconsin to Alabama, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, nearly 8 million people have flooded across the nation's southern border since Joe Biden took office. Laura Reese from the Heritage Foundation is here to talk about America's immigration crisis. Mike Johnson is the new Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, putting an end to a weeks-long leadership stalemate. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. A lack of spending restraint in Washington is feeding the continued high rate of inflation. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine and Veronique DeRugge from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University are here to explain. And there is no case for claiming a moral equivalence between Israel and the terrorist group Hamas. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA tells us why on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Biden administration's lax immigration policies have unleashed a flood of nearly 8 million illegal immigrants since he took office. Many of them have arrived under the radar, spawning a surge in both fentanyl and human trafficking. Here with details is Laura Reese. She is director of the Security and Immigration Center at the Heritage Foundation. Laura, welcome to American Radio Journal. Laura, we keep hearing all sorts of news reports about the number of immigrants that are coming across the border, most of them, if not all of them, illegally. Talk a little bit, if you will, to begin here about the scope of the problem.
We have reached historic levels of illegal immigration under the Biden administration. From day one, he came in and halted very effective policies too that had been maintaining border security. And so the numbers have rapidly risen under Joe Biden. His first year in office, we saw over 1 million illegal alien encounters by U.S. Customs and Border Protection. To contrast that, in 2020, we had 646,000 for the year. So Biden's first year, that jumps to over 1.9 million. His second year in office, 2022, that jumped to over 2.7 million illegal alien encounters. And we just received the final month numbers, September, for 2023 fiscal year. And that year was over 3.2 million illegal aliens. So grand total under Biden's administration is 7.6 million illegal aliens that CBP has encountered either between the ports of entry by the Border Patrol or at ports of entry, also by CBP.
So we have this flood of illegal immigrants coming, illegal aliens coming into the country here, Laura. This raises the question, is this opening the door for terrorists to come into the country? And also, what impact is that having on the illegal drug trade, including fentanyl, which has become a major problem in states all across the country?
Yes, it absolutely opens the door to terrorism. So in addition to the eye-popping number I gave you, 7.6 million illegal aliens, is another at least 1.6 million known gotaways. These are people who evaded the Border Patrol, but CBP uses the term known because they can trace footprints, they can see images on video, et cetera. And in addition to that population, there's an unknown number of gotaways, which we obviously don't have a number for. But looking at the 1.6 million known gotaways for a moment. So as part of Biden's open border, he has been shoveling hundreds of millions, really billions of dollars to non-governmental organizations or NGOs to help carry this open border agenda out. So there are NGOs all along the southern border, but also clear down to Panama, and they receive illegal aliens, process them, and then give them a plane ticket or a bus ticket anywhere in the U.S. that the alien wants to go to. So they're providing shelter, food, they provide other social services. And when someone chooses to not turn themselves in to Border Patrol and get a free ticket anywhere that they want to go, but rather evade the Border Patrol, these known gotaways, They're doing so for a reason. They don't want to be captured. They don't want to be fingerprinted, because among them are going to be terror watch list hits, convicted aggravated felons, drug smugglers, human traffickers, gang members. Another historic number for Biden, that 1.6 million known gotaways that we have to be very worried about for terror threats. And that number finishes up fiscal year 23, but you know, just the first weeks of October, CBP has been seeing too many more aliens from special interest countries as well.
This is, of course, very deeply concerning, and Republicans in Congress are wanting to try and get a grip on the situation, bring some control to the border. They have proposed H.R. 2. Want to talk a bit about what H.R. 2 would do?
Well, the Biden administration simply wants more money to keep this processing enterprise going. What is truly needed to stop the flow is our policy changes, and this is where H.R. 2 comes in. This is the Secure the Border Act. The House passed it in May of this year, and it has many key provisions to solve long-term illegal immigration problems that we have suffered. For example, asylum fraud. Asylum is, I view, the second most important immigration benefit that we give as a country after U.S. citizenship. And yet, it is highly, highly defrauded, because people know if they come in and say a few words of fear, they can get into the U.S. and then eventually file an asylum claim, because it'll be years before their case is heard and ultimately decided. And people use this to game the system and to stay in the U.S. longer. And so H.R. 2 includes provisions like, if you are truly fleeing for your life, you must apply for asylum in the first safe country in which you enter, not traverse five countries to country shop because you wanted to come to the U.S. all along and then claim asylum. And if you do that, we're going to send you back to that first safe country you entered. And if you want to apply for asylum there, go ahead. We did this under the Trump administration, and it was very effective. H.R. 2 would also mandate the Remain in Mexico program. Right now, the immigration statute reads that the secretary may send someone back to Mexico to await their proceedings. H.R. 2 changes that to shall. And again, that was a very effective tool, because when prior to that, we had caravans of illegal aliens coming to our border, because they knew they could say a few words of fear, get in and disappear. But when we implemented the Remain in Mexico program and they learned that, no, they had to stay in Mexico, they could still apply for asylum, but they weren't going to live in the U.S. to do it, then the caravan stopped coming.
America's border insecurity. We've been talking with Laura Reese, who is director of the Border Security and Immigration Center at the Heritage Foundation, based in Washington, D.C. Laura's obviously written extensively about this and other immigration issues. Laura, tell us a bit about Heritage. Where can folks go also on the web to read your various policy briefs and other writings on this topic?
They can go to heritage.org. We have an immigration page. And Heritage is a conservative think tank, and we focus on trying to build an America where freedom, opportunity, prosperity, and civil society can flourish. And so that's sorely needed these days, and hope people will go to the website and check it out.
Indeed. Laura Reese of the Heritage Foundation. Laura, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on the Capitol, where finally we have a new Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. Scott, good to have you here.
Well, it's great to be back, Loman. Thank you.
Tell us a bit, our new House Speaker, Mike Johnson.
Yeah, Mike Johnson was elected the 56th Speaker of the House of Representatives this week, and it's a big deal because obviously Congress has been going without a Speaker since October 7th. I think that a lot of the work that the House would have been doing in the interim period is mostly messaging bills and all these big negotiations that happen on appropriations and other parts of the Republican agenda are sort of dead on arrival in the Senate, and they ultimately result in a bipartisan negotiation. But it is important to have the leadership in place. And now that Kevin McCarthy was vacated, we went through rounds of trying for Steve Scalise, then trying for Jim Jordan, and trying for Tom Emmer. And this week, there was just this big relief, I think, from a lot of members that they were able to settle on somebody that ultimately was acceptable to everyone. He received no opposition from the Republican conference, and only one member missed the vote because I believe he was in Israel this week. So Mike Johnson from the 4th District of Louisiana is now Speaker of the House and in the line of succession for President of the United States.
Tell us a little bit about Mike Johnson. Even though he has been really a low-profile member, at least from the public perspective, he has quite a history inside the House and has been really a player, although, as I said, most people in the general public, this is a new name for them.
With Mike Johnson, he's somebody that came into the U.S. House of Representatives in 2017 and had only served one term in the Louisiana House. So fairly new to politics, really, over the last 10 years. So he's not one of those career politicians. He had significant experience as a constitutional law attorney and small business owner. And I think what people like about Mike Johnson is sort of his humble beginnings, coming from being the first one in his family to go to college. His father was a firefighter that suffered from a devastating injury while in the line of duty as a fireman. And really, Johnson has sort of been this, I think, fairly active member of the House Judiciary Committee, working alongside people like Chairman Jim Jordan to try to put together strong packages that, number one, protect the rights of the American people and enforce the rule of law, and then reform areas that are necessary within policy, like the big immigration bill that the House passed earlier this year. Mike Johnson is he's a family guy, too. I think he's got 4 kids, and he's a rock-solid social conservative. There's going to be a lot of people, I think, that kind of try to adjudicate the votes and positions that he's taken in the past now that he's in charge of the House. Nonetheless, I think he is going to be a speaker that opens things up to the rank and file of the membership and tries to include more voices in the path forward on a lot of these really important decisions that our country needs.
So where do we go to from here now, Scott? We have a new Speaker of the House. They can finally get down to business. We are just weeks away from yet another budget deadline. Is the House now going to be able to actually get to work and try to resolve some of the fiscal issues that are in front of it?
The first thing you should expect is for the House to try to pass these individual appropriation bills. Mr. Johnson noticed a schedule that will complete all those appropriation bills that remain in the House, sending them over to the Senate. And then he sort of laid out his vision for the other legislation that the House is going to work on, including the farm bill. And then in the meantime, I think you're also going to see real negotiations begin with the administration and Senate Democrats on the path forward for the November 17th deadline when the CR expires and how that looks for the year-end package on appropriations.
There are also a number of foreign affairs issues that are facing the House. There's been some division within the Republican conference over further aid to Ukraine. There's also likely going to be additional aid put forward for Israel. Do you see this as something that's going to be high on the new speaker's agenda as well?
I do. I think that he wants to address the situation in Israel, the supplemental appropriations package that would be separate from Ukraine money. And I think that those are also two very different foreign policy objectives in this moment in history, and I think it's appropriate to divide the two questions. There's also money that the administration has requested basically to process more asylum claims at the border. They call it border security supplemental spending, but it's really not about border security with the Biden administration. I think that everybody knows we've had 8 million people come illegally across the border since Biden was sworn in as president. So seeing how the supplemental appropriations comes through the House is going to come to fruition for the United States Senate. You could also see the Senate trying to jam the House, but I think that Speaker Johnson and the House Republicans would divide the question and ultimately result in a package that first addresses Israel and then a subsequent package that may receive a big debate on what to do in Ukraine.
Politically speaking here, Scott, this extended battle over who's going to be the House Speaker, has this done damage to Republican chances to retain control of the House, or ultimately is this more of an insider game?
I think that the American people consume so much information that by the time next November rolls around, there's going to be plenty of other things that are front and center in America, whether it's your kitchen table issues, whether it's just the enormous focus that's going to fall on the presidential race, or it could be any of these sort of wild cards that come up, the October surprise. And so I don't think that the dysfunction that we've seen over the last couple of weeks is actually going to hurt the House Republicans and their ability to win elections in November 2024. I do think that there's some donor questions about the direction of the House, and that's something that Speaker Johnson is going to have to figure out because he's not known as a prolific fundraiser.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based in Washington, D.C. Our members are united in economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. Check us out at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Inflation continues to ravage American families, and a lack of spending restraint in Washington is to blame. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Veronique DeRugi of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University.
If you're annoyed that inflation is still running as high as it is, my guest today says that you've got to look at fiscal policy and spending restraint in Washington. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Veronique DeRugi. She is the chairman of political economics at the Mercatus Center. That's a think tank at George Mason University, and she's a friend of the show. She's been here several times before, and we welcome her back for a few minutes now. Vero, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This news got buried this week under obviously some major geopolitical things that are happening, but we have the final deficit numbers for the fiscal year that ended at the end of September. The country ran a $1.7 trillion deficit. It's really more like a $2 trillion deficit once you do some adjustments for the student loan forgiveness stuff that isn't included in the main calculation there. Regardless of which number you pick, the deficit has jumped significantly from where it was a year ago, and it looks like it's going to continue climbing in the future. This trajectory is, for all the things Joe Biden said about bringing the deficit down during his first year in office, the trajectory is now decidedly in the other direction.
And the thing that's kind of interesting is that these numbers reveal is that it's not just that actually the deficit is going up compared to what the deficit projection were like when President Biden took office, but it's also literally, it's gone up quite dramatically in the last year. That's what CBO numbers are showing. It's like it's significantly higher than what it was projected in 2021, but also in 2022.
Yeah, the projections were kind of overly rosy to begin with, and now we're exceeding even those. One of the things that's driving all of this, and I mean, we could talk about Social Security and Medicare all day. I mean, those are kind of the big drivers here of the debt. But then the kind of secret thing here is the interest payments on the debt, paying basically our annual credit card bill on the money that we've already borrowed. There's $33 trillion now that has been borrowed, and we're borrowing at a rate of $1 to $2 trillion a year, so we keep adding to it. As that pile of debt gets bigger, and as interest rates have shot up, like that's really changing the calculus on some of these decisions.
Well, I wish it would change the calculus on these decisions, but it doesn't actually seem to be shaking Congress into actually really talking about fiscal reforms. Your listeners may not know, because most people don't know, that a third of our debt has a maturity of less than a year, and 52% of our debt has a maturity of 3 years or less. So it means that actually a majority of our debt is financed in a very short-term basis. And the reason why this matters is because interest rates, as you said, are like going up quite dramatically. And so it's not just that in the last few years we've borrowed a lot of money at a lower rate that is now coming due and creating interest payments that are just quite dramatic, but it's also because we've spent literally the last 20 years borrowing a lot of money, and even more than we would have had under the presumption that interest rates would never go up.
I mean, it's not a perfect analogy, I guess, but it's a little bit like, I think most people assume the national debt works a little bit like their mortgage, where you have a locked in rate. And even if I have a low mortgage rate, because I bought a house a few years ago, interest rates have gone up, that doesn't affect me. The federal government doesn't have that luxury. When interest rates go up, the debt becomes a lot more expensive. And that's what we're seeing now.
No. So the idea, right, was of rolling that debt is like you take advantage of those low rates. And that's great as long as the low rates stay low. But when they don't stay low, right, you're in a bind.
Yeah, that's exactly where we are now. We're talking with Veronique DeRuggi from the Mercatus Center, talking about kind of the state of fiscal policy in the U.S. It's a bit of a mess at the moment. It has been for a while, Vero. This is something we were talking about before we came on air here about how basically after a period of borrowing, there's always an assumption of fiscal tightening, of restraint in future spending, of having to basically pay for all of the dessert that you just ate. Tell us a little bit about that here in the final minute that we have, because I think that's been lost, I think, in this recent phase of massive amounts of borrowing, massive amounts of spending coming out of the pandemic. The other half of that equation has just been gone.
Yes. And I won't bore you with the actual economic and central bank models, but what I will say is that your listeners can just think back of the debates we were having right after the financial crisis, right? Deficits had gone up to $1.5 trillion, which seems like baby deficits now when we think about it. And President Obama was saying, the deficits will come down when we're out of the emergency, signaling that something was going to be done. And sure enough, after the financial crisis, we had all these talks about austerity, how we should do it, do it just spending or spending in taxes and just the information is that it should be actually a fiscal adjustment done mostly on spending. That's the way you really truly get a reduction of your deficit level. And this time around, there's none of that. There's literally no one is talking about austerity. No one is talking about we had to spend. So, I mean, the president says he's cutting the deficit, but it's just obviously not true because, as we said, the deficit's going up. And that no one is having a national conversation about, okay, how does austerity come about? That problem of our debt that we're accumulating without ever considering cutting spending or raising taxes could be taken care of with more inflation in the future. And so what happens is like expectation of future inflation becomes inflation today.
Yeah, and if we don't get this under control via fiscal policy, if there isn't some tightening, then you're just going to continue to see inflation rise because we've got to deal with that one way or another. The inflation is one way of dealing with the problem. It would be better if we had this conversation, a conversation that's really not happening right now, as you said, in Washington, but we desperately need to have it. That is unfortunately all the time we have for today. Veronique DeRuggi, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that is Veronique DeRuggi. She's the chairman of political economics at the Mercatus Center. Check out her work online at mercatus.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out everything we're covering this week around the country and around the world as well at reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
There is no moral equivalence between Hamas and its terrorist attacks and Israel's defense of its people. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The pro-Palestinian left in America is engaged in a subtle but relentless campaign to claim a moral equivalence between Hamas and Israel. Listeners to American Radio Journal should see it for what it is, propaganda. And like all propaganda, it is deceitful to the core. There's a simple way to examine the horrors of war, and they occur on all sides in all conflicts. And that is to differentiate between the parties morally. The key element is stated intention. Hamas intends to kill as many Israelis as possible without regard to whether or not they are combatants. The stated objective of Hamas is clearly expressed in its charter, that the territory between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River is by divine right Palestinian, and it accepts no coexistence with Israel, no two-state solution. An earlier version of the Hamas charter is more specific about removing all Jews from that area by any and all means, including genocidal extermination. In that shocking view, there is no meaningful distinction between killing Israeli armed forces and killing Israeli babies. Therefore, the stated intention of Hamas is genocide, and genocide must be condemned. That does not mean that Israel cannot be criticized for excessive use of force, negligence in not trying to minimize civilian casualties, inhumanely cutting off food and water, and so on. But as odious as those potential acts may be, they are in no sense comparable to genocide. Israel's stated intention is defense, not offense. Israel's rockets, missiles, artillery barrages, airstrikes, and ground assaults are all targeted. Sometimes the targeting is wrong, or it doesn't work properly, and collateral damage and deaths occur, but not because innocent victims were targeted. Hamas's stated intention, on the other hand, is total annihilation of Israel and establishment of a Palestinian state in its place, occupying all the land that now comprises Israel, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank. It doesn't matter to Hamas where the rockets land or whom they kill. Similarly, Hamas's use of their own people as human shields is immoral. Tens of thousands of rockets fired so far by Hamas are, in one important aspect, different from Israel's munitions. They are untargeted. The difference between targeted and untargeted weapons may seem technical or even trivial to the average person, but from a moral standpoint, it is significant. The American left is largely supportive of the Palestinian people and thus inescapably supportive of Hamas. This past weekend, the Episcopal Diocese of Pennsylvania debated a resolution condemning, quote, Israel's entrenched discriminatory rule over Palestinians that amounts to the international wrong of apartheid, unquote. The resolution is silent on the matter of Hamas's brutal and inhumane attacks on Israel or their ultimate genocidal intent. The resolution was defeated, but only narrowly. The very facts that it was first conceived and then formally qualified for the agenda are outrageous and telling. Many people in the leadership of that church, which happens to be my own, serve as an example of how close to de facto support of genocide that Christian body has drifted. The Philadelphia Inquirer reports that hundreds of students at Philadelphia's three largest universities protested in solidarity with Palestinian people in the war-torn Gaza Strip on Wednesday, part of a groundswell of walkouts at campuses nationwide over how the academic institutions align themselves in the conflict. Penn students were shown in a video to chant, Israel, you cannot hide, we charge you with genocide. The term genocide is not one to be thrown about loosely. It is a serious term, one with great moral significance. Israel's treatment of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank may be subject to criticism as harsh, but it is not genocide. Hamas's strike on Israel and the long-term strategic goals of Hamas and Hezbollah fit the definition of genocide precisely. There is no moral equivalence between harshness and genocide. Listeners to American Radio Journal know that, and we must be bold in objecting any time the moral equivalence argument is floated. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WMCHAM in Kingsport, Tennessee. Welcome to our new listeners in the Volunteer State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program by visiting our all-new website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.